trivia at 6:30 and open mic night Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows near 3 below, and tomorrow slight chance of snow in the afternoon with highs 10 to 15.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Logging off, Australia's social media ban is now in effect. That means children and teens there are losing access to their favorite platforms. Some parents are celebrating that. But our guest says her child, who's quadriplegic, is actually losing a source of much-needed social connection.
And literary retail therapy. Sophie Kinsella's Shopaholic series of books found an audience far beyond what their author ever believed possible. A fan and editor of the late Ms. Kinsella tells us why.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
We'll have more ahead from As It Happens in a few minutes here on People Powered KAXE. Thanks so much for tuning in. Well, it is December and time to be looking back at the year, our favorites. I'm going to play one of my favorites in just a few moments, but we want to hear your favorites too. You can share your favorite albums and songs from 2025 with us. Find a form at KAXE.org. I was very excited to hear some new music from Spoon this summer. They dropped two new singles late in the summer. This one's called Chateau Blues.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this Friday and Saturday, December 12th and 13th, in Aiken, Virginia, LaPorte, and Bemidji. First up, Corey Medina is playing at Sampaguita in Aiken, Friday at 6 p.m. The blues singer and guitarist will be playing solo without the brothers, sharing stories and stripped-down versions of their blues rock tunes. It is Friday night, 6 p.m. at Sampaguita in Aiken, Corey Medina. At 7 o'clock, Rich and Jermaine are playing the Arrowhead Bar in Virginia. musical, and life partners, Rich Mattson and Jermaine Gemberling play folk, rock, country, and more in their duo shows outside the North Stars. The Arrowhead is a newly remodeled venue in downtown Virginia that has been hosting live music regularly. It's Rich and Jermaine Friday night at 7 p.m. A final Friday show is the jam rock group Bumps on a Log at the Woodshed in La Porte. They are a jam and funk duo of Garrett and Grant Radatz, who also play in groups like Forge North and Mudsong. This show is an ugly Christmas sweater party, Friday, 7 p.m. at the Woodshed in La Porte. On to Saturday, Sam Miltich and the Clearwater Hot Club in trio form will be at Bridget's Irish Pub, bringing high-quality hot club, traditional jazz, and Balkan folk songs to Bemidji, Saturday at 6 o'clock. Do you have information on live music you'd like us to know about? Email comments at kaxc.org. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Clause celeb, the Alberta government has used the notwithstanding clause yet again, this time to push through laws that will affect young transgender people. A trans advocate tells us it is too much and they've gone too far.
Laying it on the pipeline, a Liberal MP says he has concerns about an Alberta-built pipeline, but Conservative attempts to get MPs like him to break from the federal government are not going to fly.
Unmaking connections, Australia enacts the world's first social media ban for children under the age of 16. One woman tells us that for her son, who has a disability, it is like losing a lifeline.
Tread carefully. A Royal Canadian Navy sailor is rescued after going missing in the Pacific Ocean. We'll talk to a commander on a ship that got the Mayday call.
Shop Talk will remember Sophie Kinsella, whose Confessions of a Shopaholic novels earned her legions of fans. Her editor tells us the author was as special as her books.
And you can't smell the forest for the trees. After we heard about a rank ginkgo tree in a historic Nova Scotia garden, we heard from you about your own ginkgo struggles and how you overcame them. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that turns over an ew leaf. Very early this morning, Alberta's government made a decision that will change the lives of transgender people in the province. Premier Danielle Smith and her majority caucus invoked the notwithstanding clause again, this time to push through legislation called Bill 9, or the Protecting Alberta's Children Statutes Amendment Act. The act polices names and pronouns in schools, bans transgender girls from participating in amateur female sports, and prohibits doctors from prescribing puberty blockers and hormone therapy for those under 16. Invoking the notwithstanding clause means Bill 9 is immune to constitutional challenges and cannot be overturned by the courts. The bill was debated all night long before the government passed it, and watching from the gallery was trans woman and activist Marnie Panis. We reached her in Edmonton.
Marnie, why did you stay in that chamber till the wee hours of the morning to watch this bill that is painful for you pass?
It was incredibly painful, but I was there for my community, but also to be there for the opposition party, the NDP, who have been fighting so hard on our behalf. It was my time to show them support and thanks for the support that they've been showing us.
So it passed 2 o'clock in the morning, if I'm not mistaken, is when this bill passed. And in that moment, after all those hours, how did it feel?
I mean, it wasn't a surprise that was going to pass. I think what emotions that I was having throughout the evening is watching so many of the UCP members, you know, sometimes they would look up and see us in the gallery and they'd wave and they'd smirk and smile, and then they'd go to vote to remove our rights. And then seeing some of those folks who 10 years ago in that same building speaking in favor of adding gender identity and gender expression to Alberta's Human Rights Act, I think for me it was just the shock of how callous and mean it felt, and how people can just change their values, and then to do it under the cover of darkness at 2:30 in the morning when they weren't being held accountable by Albertans. It felt terrible.
Premier Smith was not in the chamber in those moments for that final vote. Do you know why?
Oh, I have no idea why. She was there earlier because she was there during the vote when it left committee, but then didn't show up 2 hours later when this vote happened. And I don't know why. It would be a great question to ask her, because if she feels so strongly in this bill, then be there to stand for it. But I think that is really reflective of their whole approach to this bill and to all of the other legislation that's going through, that they know they're wrong. They know that this legislation is a complete violation of Canada's Constitution, our Human Rights Act, and they know it's going to cause real harm, but they don't care. That's what that says to me.
We did request an interview with Premier Smith, and we have in the past on other stories as well. We also requested an interview with the Justice Minister. Both declined. We did receive a statement from the Minister. It says in part, quote, Bill 9 preserves the choices of children and youth, strengthens the role of parents as a child's primary caregiver, and ensures fairness and safety in amateur competitive sports. Alberta's A United Conservative government will be unapologetic in our commitment to those principles, unquote. You've heard versions of that statement over the years, I'm sure. How does it sit with you in this moment?
It's absolutely ridiculous, because they say that on one hand, but they do something completely different in their legislation. They are not protecting Alberta's children. They're putting trans children at risk. They're putting all women and girls at risk. They say they protect the relationship and the choice. They've taken choice away from youth and adults. They've taken away the rights of parents to support their child. They've taken away the rights of a parent and child to engage with their healthcare provider to provide necessary care. They talk about protecting choice and freedom and parental rights, but they've taken all of those things away. And the hypocrisy is so profound. It's rights for them, but not for anyone else.
I spoke in September with Amelia Newbert, who manages is the managing director of the Skipping Stone Foundation, and the nonprofit was challenging two of these laws. What's your sense of where this all leaves organizations like Skipping Stone, who've been trying to fight this in court?
Yeah, Skipping Stone and EGAL in Canada have done so much hard work, not only at the judiciary level, but also to support trans youth and their families in the front lines. And they're going to continue to do that, I have no doubt. The fight is certainly not over. This is one of the lowest points that I've ever experienced in my work, certainly a lowest point for me as an Albertan citizen, born and raised here. But the fight isn't over. It's we might be beaten down, we're tired, we're exhausted, but we come back stronger, and we will. This is not the end.
What, if anything, are you saying at this stage, or in preparation for what you were expecting to happen in the chamber last night or early this morning, in terms of trans young people, what you've been saying to them to prepare them for this?
To continue to find their social supports, find their networks of support, to reach out, to know that they're not alone. And this is why even doing an interview like this is so important to me, because the one thing that I have, the one power that I have, is my visibility and my voice. And for these trans youth to see trans people like me living their lives fully and proudly and joyfully, because they deserve those things. They deserve that too.
Oh, Marnie, I'm sorry. Does this take you back to when you were younger?
Well, sure. I'm 55 now, approaching 55. When I was younger, growing up in Camrose, Alberta, smallish town here, I never had the language to articulate how I felt. I didn't even hear the word trans until I was in my 30s, but I just knew I didn't fit into what was expected of me. And today, and a lot more youth have the language to articulate how they felt, and for many feel a little bit safer, or at least they did, until their government came and created an unsafe environment for them. Today, we've been taken back to even further than to where we started 10 years ago. But these youth, if any of them are listening, just know that you deserve to be happy. You deserve to be believed. You deserve to be loved. You deserve to grow up in a world that is safe for you and welcoming for you. And you deserve all of those things. Never, ever forget that.
Marnie, I appreciate this. Thank you. Please take care.
I will. Really appreciate you. Thanks so much, Neil.
We reached Marnie Panis in Edmonton. This morning, millions of kids in Australia looked up from their phones and tablets, blinked, and thought, what now? The country has become the first in the world to ban social media apps like Instagram, TikTok, and Twitch for users under 16 years old. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said the law was passed to protect children from the well-documented mental health impacts of being too online and to, quote, make sure that Australian children have a childhood, unquote. Social media companies that violate the ban will face tens of millions of dollars in fines. Natasha Shawl is the mother of a 15-year-old who's quadriplegic. We reached her in Melbourne, Australia.
Natasha, now that this ban is a reality and it impacts Ezra directly, how is he dealing with that?
He is the kind of kid that, I mean, he's had to go through a lot in his short life, and he's the kind of kid that will just adapt and take things as they come. But I think he's very disappointed and worried for the future. We're about to hit summer holidays here in Australia. His friends will be out and about doing things that he'd love to be doing, but because of his disability, he isn't able to do sort of those, what we, I guess, consider regular teenage things with them. Mm-hmm. And social media sort of, you know, served to fill that gap, the things that he would love to be doing, playing basketball, playing Australian rules footy, going to parties. You know, he still does, he'll still socialise and see his friends, but social media really helped to connect him when he couldn't necessarily do all the things he wants to do as a teenager.
How often and in what ways was he using these platforms?
I think he was probably using them daily, but in a really sensible, responsible way. I don't think his behaviour specifically is the issue. It's the social media platforms themselves. So he would follow NBA accounts. He'd follow his favourite Australian rules football team. He loved watching movies, so he'd rate and review movies. So his behaviour was really sensible, really reasonable, really mature. I think the issue with online platforms like these is actually adult behaviour and the predatory platforms themselves. And by banning kids like Ezra, they're taking away his way to socialise, his way to communicate, his way to have a community, and they're not actually changing the behaviour that's the problem. They're not holding platforms responsible or accountable or enforcing regulation. So they've taken away his way to engage with the world, and they haven't actually fixed the issue.
Ezra, it wasn't available at the time we're reaching you today, but he has spoken out publicly about
Correct.
This ban. He spoke with The Guardian, as you did. We have a little clip from that conversation,
sure.
So I want to play that for our listeners.
I can't go outside and play basketball with my mates, can't play footy with them, and social media is one of the few ways I can still socialize with my friends. Not being able to use social media anymore because I'm under 16 really makes my life a lot harder. It's going to really disconnect me from the world, I think. It's going to be a lot more difficult to socialise with friends. It's going to be a lot more difficult to make new friends. It's going to really make my world a lot smaller.
So he's 15 now, as our listeners heard earlier, Natasha. For him specifically, you know, you've got about a year, maybe less, until he's able to access social media again, if I'm not mistaken. But how do you strategize? What kind of conversations, what kinds of conversations do you have with Ezra to get through this next stretch?
I mean, he's just such a mature, responsible kid that he'll find ways to engage in the world. You know, we have movie nights. He watches movies with his dads. We'll get out and about as much as physically possible. But, I mean, he does have a severe disability. He is quadriplegic. So things like not being able to use his arms and legs means the things that he would love to be doing each day, he can't. So there's not a way to replace his social media time, his sort of chill time. We can't replace that with other things, because for him that was independence. He's got technology on his phone that allows him to do that all independently, and that's really important for a teenage kid, especially one with a disability, to be able to have that independence, to be able to socialise on their terms. And we can't replace that as parents. I mean, our Prime Minister suggested the other day, oh well, it's time for kids to get off their phones and go read a book and go kick a football and go learn an instrument. I mean, Ezra would love to pick up a guitar, but I think just what a tone deaf, completely ableist, really inappropriate thing to say. I think that shifts the blame onto kids. It's like the Prime Minister thinks the kids are the problem, like, oh, go out and learn a new sport. Yet the kids are doing that already, and the ones that aren't doing that for a reason. And I think there really needs to be some accountability, and the government needs to really take that into consideration.
If you were able to speak with the Prime Minister or other officials directly, sit down with them, what would you propose? You know, what kinds of measures, short of a ban, would you support?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have all the answers, but I think what we really need is regulation. What we really need is that if my son reports a post because of harmful content, we need those things to be taken very seriously. At the moment, they generally get ignored. If these platforms have the capability, and we've seen how quickly it can happen, to kick off 15-year-olds, 14-year-olds, 13-year-olds really quite quickly, it also has the ability to kick off predators, bullies, trolls. I mean, these things could happen very quickly. It's a choice not to do those things. They're profiting off teenagers, they're profiting off adults. We see it happen daily. As an adult who uses these platforms, I see how it happens. And I think these are the things that need to change. We need to make these places safe, because for kids like Ezra, this isn't just a nice to have, it's actually a must have. Social media access is his community access, and taking that away impacts him in a very severe way. It impacts other kids in regional Australia, other kids as well who use social media to do the right thing, to look into interests and hobbies and catch up with the news and communicate with friends. So I think it's a really important conversation we need to be having. No one is saying that they aren't dangerous, but I think we need to fix the issues.
Given that you're describing this as such a lifeline, and Ezra is as well for himself, I mean, have you talked about creating an account, you know, in another name?
I think we might keep those conversations private. No, I think he's the kind of kid who will stick to the rules.
It sounds like that from what you were saying. But, you know, people will try to find workarounds if it's possible.
Yeah, I mean, since his article got published, we've just had my inbox is just filled with people offering VPNs. That's not something we will do, but it just shows how many, like, there are kids are going to continue using these platforms, and they will continue to be unsafe. So it's not really the fix that I think the government is hoping it will be.
Natasha, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you so much for time.
We reached Natasha Shaw in Melbourne, Australia. Sophie Kinsella wrote what she knew: love, life, and shopping. Madeline Sophie Wickham, who mostly wrote under the pen name Sophie Kinsella, has died from brain cancer. She was 55 years old. Her family announced her death on social media today, writing, "She died peacefully, with her final days filled with her true loves, family and music and warmth and Christmas and joy." She wrote dozens of books over her career, but she's best known for her Shopaholic series, 10 novels that follow Becky Bloomwood through the trials and tribulations of life, including a shopping addiction. Her book sold more than 45 million copies worldwide. In 2014, she came to Calgary for a book signing and spoke with the CBC.
I think she's relatable. And the number of people who come up to me and say, that's exactly how I think, or, you know, you must have read my mind. I had no idea she would be so universal, to be honest. When I started writing her, I was writing just a girl in London with a few financial worries, as we all have. Sure. And I thought perhaps it would appeal to other girls with financial worries in London. I had no idea there would be so many Becky Bloomwoods all over the world.
Sophie Kinsella speaking with Doug Dirks, former host of The Home Stretch in 2014. Francesca Best was her editor for several books, including My Not-So-Perfect Life and Surprise Me. We reached her in London.
Francesca, did you consider yourself a Becky Bloomwood? Did you feel that way?
I started reading Becky's story when I was in my early 20s, so I suppose I was a similar age to her, and starting out in a career in London, and perhaps not quite as much of a shopaholic as Becky was, but there were certainly so many elements that I related to, and I just, you know, I completely remember reading that first novel, which over here was called The Secret Dream World of a Shopaholic, and absolutely, you know, laughing out loud with how funny it was, and yes, how relatable it was. You know, I could definitely put myself in Becky's shoes.
And she was clearly, Sophie Kinsella was shocked. She's saying there about how popular the series became, how relatable her character was. What do you think it was at the heart of it? I remember reading it as well. Everyone could potentially see a bit of themselves or someone they knew in there.
Yeah, I think that just that sort of escalation of a situation where you've perhaps been daydreaming a little bit, you've done something that's a bit of a, you know, you've bought something that's a bit of a splurge, a bit of an impulse purchase, and then, oh my gosh, you know, the worries, the regrets come flooding in later. And the way that, you know, Becky could just get herself in a complete pickle was so relatable, so funny.
So then, you know, you enjoy the books, then you meet Sophie Kinsella. How did that go?
So I first met her many years before I was working with her. I'd started in publishing as a young editor, and I'd met her at an industry event. And I thought, I'm such a fan of hers, I can't not go over and say, you know, thank you for your books. I love them. I love you. And I think she was somewhat taken aback by this massive fangirl moment that I sort of went over and accosted her. But she was so gracious, and she was so nice about it, and just sort of laughed along with me, my gushing adoration of her. And then many years later, I got a job at her publishing company, and I was told, you know, the previous editor is retiring and you're going to be taking over as Sophie's editor. And it was the biggest pinch me moment. You know, I think I squealed. I was just absolutely over the moon. Real dream come true to work with her.
And what was it like, that work, when you got down to it?
She was such a pro. She knew exactly what she was doing. You know, she was such a smart, funny woman who, you know, she'd written many books by then. The Shopaholic series had been incredibly successful. I started working with her at kind of some of the later books in the series, and then some of her standalones after that. And she didn't, you know, she really didn't need much work. Myself and her US editor, who had the, you know, the fortunate job of editing her, hardly had to sort of make that many suggestions, because she was such a pro.
I can't remember if it was, if the phrase chick lit arose in direct connection, you know, as soon as her books came out, but it was certainly thrown around a lot. And I remember bristling at it. it's derisive and dismissive. That's how I took it. And, you know, whether people loved her books or not, just that characterization, you know, was off-putting for a lot of people. She spoke with the CBC, as, you know, our listeners heard earlier on ahead of our conversation. In that same interview, she talks about that term and that characterization. So we'll listen to that.
Well, you know, I feel the phrase chick lit and I are old friends. We've been through our ups and downs. You know, I kind of think, what does chick lit even mean? Does it mean written by women, for women? I think it's kind of weird to prescribe a readership by their gender. I mean, I think I'm writing for anyone with a sense of humor.
That graciousness you're talking about, I think, is on display there. But also clarity. What would you say, what did you say to people who would dismiss the work as fluff?
I think, you know, people don't realize how hard it is to write something that reads so easily. You know, people read these books, they escape into them, they think they're just lighthearted and funny and they just roll along. And they don't realize actually how difficult it is to write like that. And I think, you know, there are so many readers who might dismiss these books as chick lit or sort of disposable fiction, and that's just absolutely not the case. You know, we've already talked about how relevant they are to so many people, how relatable, and I think, you know, they're very valid pieces of fiction, and to call them chick lit is derisive, and you know they speak to a much wider audience than yeah. chicks.
You weren't working together anymore. I know you kept in touch periodically when she received yeah. her diagnosis. What did you think when she decided to write a personal novel about that experience?
I thought that was just incredibly brave. She was so honest about this, you know, the terrible diagnosis that she'd received. And, you know, in order to sort of communicate her fears and her feelings and her hopes to her readers, what I thought was just very, very open and wonderful of her. Mm. And I loved that novella. I thought it was great. It was so moving and but very uplifting at the same time.
What would you like, Francesca, listeners, maybe young women, you know, who are thinking of going into this field, yeah. what would you like them to take away from the Sophie Kinsella, or Maddie as you knew her?
She's inspired so many writers out there. And I would say that if, you know, someone's looking to write their own story, absolutely do it. She would be your biggest supporter. And in terms of sort of people who are kind of just enjoying the books and love to read, you know, she's left behind an amazing legacy of so many novels for children and adults. And, you know, just enjoy them. I think she would be incredibly honored that people around the world are, you know, have loved her books for so long and taken them to their hearts.
Francesca, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Not at all. Thank you.
Francesca Best is a former editor of the late Sophie Kinsella. We reached her in London. It's a shade tree in the sense that it provides shade, also in the sense that we're about to throw shade at it. Yesterday on the program, we told you about a ginkgo tree at a historic Nova Scotia garden. Staff, including manager Trish Fry, thought it was male, so they were surprised and disgusted when they learned the 40-year-old ginkgo was female, because female ginkgo trees drop fruit-like seeds that release a powerful, horrible smell, especially when they fall on the ground and are crushed under people's feet, as Ms. Fry explained.
The scent is not at all like the beauty that they show with their fall leaves. It's sort of a cross between dog poop and vomit. It's not something I would smell on purpose over again if I could avoid it, that's for sure.
After that conversation, Michelle Harper wrote to us from Westmount, Quebec. She is a retired high school principal, and she says her school had ginkgo trees in the front yard. And every fall, the students would approach her with a blunt request, "Miss, you have to get rid of those berry trees." She writes, "I tried to get them to see the beauty in the trees and assured them the odor would pass." And she adds that some neighbors actually collected the berries for soup. Here's Fleetwood Mac with "Bear Trees." Mac with Bare Trees.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return,
we'll tell you all about the enormous and surprisingly successful search for a Navy sailor who went overboard and disappeared in the frigid Pacific. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXC. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. 7 o'clock, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Support comes from Rapids Brewing Company, a place for gathering and community, featuring live music multiple times a week, farm fresh food, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu at rapidsbrewingco.com. Weather tonight, mostly cloudy, lows near 3 below, and tomorrow slight chance of snow in the afternoon with highs 10 to 15. Lows tomorrow night, 1 to 4 below zero, and then Friday, mostly cloudy, highs in the low teens, slight chance of snow. Lows on Friday night, 18 below to 9 below zero. Mesabi Symphony Orchestra's Christmas Spectacular is this Friday, 7 o'clock at Rockridge High School in Virginia, a family-friendly evening of music, treats, and a visit from Santa. We continue now with As It Happens on KAXE.
The Conservatives had an idea, force Liberal MPs to declare their support or lack of support for a pipeline, and in doing so, reveal divisions in caucus regarding one of the key points of the recent memorandum of understanding signed with the Alberta government. And so yesterday, opposition leader Pierre Poilievre put forward a non-binding motion using some of the exact language in the MOU, calling for a new oil pipeline to the Pacific. Now, in the end, the Liberals opted to universally vote down the motion, calling it a stunt that accomplished nothing. But it may not be the last time Liberal MPs have to decide whether to go along with Prime Minister Carney's pipeline push. One prominent minister, Stephen Guilbeault, has already resigned from cabinet over the issue. Nate Erskine-Smith is a Liberal MP, and we reached him in Ottawa.
Nate Erskine-Smith, some of your Liberal colleagues called the motion that the Conservatives put forward a, quote, insult, a cynical ploy, immature. Are those the reasons you decided to join your colleagues to vote it down?
The motion that was put forward was a political game, really, to take one or a handful of elements out of the memorandum of understanding between Canada and Alberta, and not to see it as a whole. It makes no sense to play those games, and we should be focused on more serious debate in the House of Commons.
We've, of course, seen the resignation of Stephen Guilbeault from cabinet over this issue. You've said online as well that perhaps the party's given away too much with this MOU. Where do you stand on the, do you want this deal to go ahead? Do you want this pipeline to be built?
Generally speaking, I understand where the government is coming from. They want to make sure there's some political peace with Alberta to get as much done as possible. They want to diversify the market away from the United States, given the challenges with the American administration and the economic attacks. And this is able to secure some climate action. I at the same time said that this is not an adequate amount of climate action. It's really not enough from what we should and could and should expect from a climate-focused government. And while, unfortunately, the deal does see some backsliding, like it's good to have the industrial carbon price and have Alberta's efforts towards that. Walk back on methane is more challenging. The carve-out for clean electricity regulations is more challenging. So there's some weakness on the climate side here, and we need to shore that weakness up with a clear-eyed, ambitious climate plan. And I have every confidence that the government is going to pursue that plan in the new year and is going to articulate that plan to Canadians.
So you think we're going to see things and that you and others who might be concerned within your party, you're going to see things that make you feel better about what's on the table?
I expect the government to come forward with a more ambitious foot forward on climate. In the platform, we promised dollars for electric vehicle charging infrastructure. We promised dollars for home retrofits and ensuring that across sectors, we're reducing emissions and making sure we're all doing our part. And so I have every expectation that we deliver on more ambitious commitments when it comes to reducing our emissions, taking advantage of the opportunity, the economic opportunity of a clean energy economy, and recognizing that the transition is happening with or without us, and we need to make sure we put ourselves in the right economic position.
Is there a red line that you have when it comes to supporting a pipeline or this project? Is there a point that you'll no longer be able to vote with the government on this?
Well, I said in my remarks, it's important to distinguish an approval from public dollars being spent in this way. And so there are no public dollars being committed to this pipeline. It has to be privately financed. It is only a memorandum of understanding. We're a long ways off from an actual project coming to fruition. A proponent's got to step forward by July 1st. There's no proponent yet. And it requires the agreement of British Columbia, and rightfully, constitutionally, but also knowing the legacy of injustice in this country, it's absolutely essential that there is Indigenous participation and an agreement. Mm-hmm. And we are a long ways off from that project being even, you know, realized in a preliminary way. And on the climate front, yeah, we can't see the expansion of already the single largest source of emissions in this country. The oil sands and the oil and gas sector represent 31% of our total emissions. We can't see an expansion of production and emissions that go with that production on the one hand without seeing commensurate, significant, and ambitious climate action at the same time. And that's the other shoe that needs to drop.
Is this all, given the backlash and the disagreement we've seen so far? We've spoken to Indigenous leaders on the program as well. We talked about Stephen Guilbeault leaving cabinet. Is this just theater then, this MOU?
No, it's not theater, because there are specific commitments beyond the pipeline, right? So I mentioned the industrial carbon price. Well, there was a previous grant and bargain where Alberta was to commit to carbon pricing. Unfortunately, that has not been maintained in a serious way. And so we need to make sure that pricing mechanism is fit for purpose and is doing the job that we know it can do. And so that's a big part of this deal, making sure that there is clarity around stronger electricity regulations in Alberta. This is going to be a point of, I know, intense negotiation, because if we are enabling a carve out for clean electricity, it's going to require Alberta to step up in a significant way with their own provincial version of substantially similar rules.
And just finally, Nate, you know, back in May, you were removed from cabinet. You said you felt, quote, disrespected by that move. It sounds like you've managed to rebuild or maybe even repair potentially your relationship with Prime Minister Carney. Have you?
Oh, yeah, we have a great relationship. I mean, I expect to have a chat with him this afternoon. I mean, one can have disagreements around ideas. You know, I had a similar video around the budget, and there's good in that budget. There's some elements of that budget where I thought we failed to meet expectations, and then there were some things that I disagreed with around cuts to foreign aid, as an example. And I think it's important in our Liberal Party and politics more generally, but especially in our party, it's a big tent party. Your job is and push your party to be the best version of itself. And the Prime Minister is very much welcoming of that. I mean, he doesn't suffer fools. He wants smart ideas and people to push him to be better. And I think that's the job of a member of Parliament.
Nate, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nate Erskine-Smith is a Liberal MP for the Toronto riding of Beaches, East York. We reached him in Ottawa. Today was a day of Nobel Prize pomp and circumstance, as this year's laureates convened in Stockholm and Oslo to celebrate. But one notable recipient was not at the podium. Maria Corina Machado, who won the Peace Prize for her efforts to restore democracy in Venezuela, announced today that she had left Venezuela after more than a year in hiding and is on her way to Oslo. But she didn't make it in time for the ceremony, so her daughter spoke on her behalf. Here's Ana Corina Sosa Machado speaking at Oslo City Hall today.
I am here on behalf of my mother, Maria Corina Machado, who has united millions of Venezuelans in an extraordinary effort that you, our hosts, have honored with a Nobel Peace Prize. But although she has not been able to be here and take part in this ceremony, I must say that my mother never breaks a promise. And that is why, with all the joy in my heart, I can tell you that in just a few hours, we will be able to embrace her here in Oslo after 16 months living in here. And as I await that moment to hug her, to kiss her, to embrace her after 2 years, I think of the other daughters and sons who do not get to see their mothers today. This is what drives her, what drives all of us. She wants to live in a free Venezuela, and she will never give up on that purpose. That is why we all know, and I know, that she will be back in Venezuela very soon. My dear Venezuelans, the world has marveled at what we have achieved. And soon it will witness one of the most moving sights of our time, our loved ones coming home. And I will stand again on the Simon Bolivar Bridge, where I once cried, the thousands who were leaving, and welcome them back into the luminous life that awaits us. Because in the end, our journey towards freedom has always lived inside us. We are returning to ourselves. We are returning home.
That was Ana Karina Sosa Machado, daughter of Nobel Peace Prize winner Maria Karina Machado, speaking at the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo today.
Two vessels en route and one chopper in the hover over top.
He just waved his hand. He just waved his hand up. He is alive.
There was a dramatic and urgent situation off the coast of Bentinck Island, BC, on Monday. That afternoon, a member of the Royal Canadian Navy fell off a small inflatable boat and went missing. You just heard a crucial moment of conversation in the cockpit of a helicopter that was searching the area. The area they had to search was enormous, but the ensuing rescue operation was just as big. David Patchell is a Rear Admiral and Commander of the Maritime Forces Pacific. We reached him in Victoria.
Admiral, have you had a chance to see or speak with the sailor at the center of all this? How are they doing?
Yeah, so they're doing very well. They're at home with family. I've not spoken to them yet. They had medical assistance on Monday night, released to their family on Tuesday morning, so they're doing well. We'll let them recover, and then we'll have a chance to speak to them.
How long might that recovery take?
So, health-wise, they're doing well. They were lucid. They were talking as they were recovered. But there's always the shock of such an ordeal.
Yeah.
And so we will just be, monitoring, providing supports, including with our Padres and chaplains. And then we'll talk to the member, and really both members who are on the boat.
Yeah. Our listeners heard a little bit of the rescue from the footage the military released. But what do you know about what happened? How did the sailor fall overboard?
So on Monday afternoon, we have sailors out in small boats. We call them rigid hull inflatable boats doing training.
Mm-hmm.
And they were on their way back to Esquimalt Harbor. And as normal operating procedures, there were two sailors in the boat, one boat coxswain who was driving, and then assistant. And the driver was actually ejected from the boat. Now, we are still conducting the investigation. That will take some time as to exactly what happened. But we do know the driver was ejected from the boat. They had a kill switch attached, which means that the motor immediately switched off. The second sailor in the boat reported that the sailor who went in the water went underneath the boat and then was lost.
And when did you get the call?
So, as a matter of coincidence, I was at sea on Monday on board HMCS Regina. Mm-hmm. Not normal for an admiral. Sadly, I don't get to be at sea very often. So relatively quickly, as most ships at sea do, we were alerted as to the Mayday. And so very quickly understood that there was a person in the water, and then rapidly found out it was one of the Royal Canadian Navy sailors in the water.
And what kind of conditions are we talking about on the water on that day?
Yeah, so about 9 degrees Celsius,
not
winds
warm.
30 miles an hour, and significant wave heights. So quite significant weather and low visibility, as is pretty normal here in Victoria this time of year.
So what did you do after getting the call?
So two sailors in the boat, one falls over. The second sailor had the wherewithal to call their supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
That supervisor immediately called the Joint Rescue Coordination Center in Victoria, who initiated the search and rescue right away. And so at that point, helicopters, an aircraft, and multiple ships responded to the search and rescue to begin searching for our missing sailor.
Yeah, and you were there as the rescue was being carried out, right? Were you close by?
Yeah, so Regina was about 45 minutes away, but was fascinating as we sailed up to the scene in vicinity of the missing person was the amount of activity. So you can see the helicopters in the air. You can see the ships, Canadian Coast Guard ship, a Royal Canadian Navy Orca patrol vessels had responded, as well as Pacific Guardian, which is a Pacific pilotage vessel. And they were all there searching together. So it was impressive to see the amount and the rapidity of the response.
How long did it take in all?
Yeah, so in total, the sailor was in the water for about 2 hours. And so from the time of the distress call, which was about 2:43, we located the sailor around 5 p.m. So they were in the water for just over 2 hours.
And, I mean, are they wearing kind of gear that could allow them to stay in that water any longer than that? What kind of,
yes.
What kind of timeline were you operating under?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So fortunately, they were in a dry suit, and they had a life jacket on. So they had the right equipment to survive in the water for a number of hours. So I'm very grateful that they were wearing the proper equipment.
You've talked about with our CBC News colleagues that you know, this is obviously the best case scenario, the best result, but still that it's an emotional time. Can you expand on that a little bit? How are you feeling? How's the rest of your team feeling?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there is an immediate worry when we hear of someone missing at sea. There's worry, there's concern. We all think of our own shipmates and shipmates that we've lost in the past. And I'll say that we get to worry for about 10 seconds, and then we need to turn our focus into doing everything that we can to find our missing shipmate.
Have you ever been in this situation before, either as the person, you know, who put out the Mayday or having to execute a rescue like this one?
That's a great question. I've never been the person putting out a Mayday. I have been involved in multiple search and rescues throughout my career. And they're not always for military members. Mm-hmm. We answer about 2,500 search and rescue calls a year here in the Pacific region. But I will say that life at sea is dangerous. Life at sea is dangerous for all mariners. And so that's why we train, that's why we equip, that's why we recruit more and more Canadians to come and work within the Navy so that we can manage those risks at sea. But we have to always acknowledge just how dangerous an environment the sea is.
And how is the second sailor doing?
Both sailors are doing well.
Okay.
The sailor that was in the water was talking as they were rescued. Okay. So as the helicopter approached, so it was a Cyclone helicopter who found the person in the water, actually visually. So it wasn't any complicated sensor. It was the air crew that spotted what they first thought was a log. They got closer and found the person, and the mm-hmm. person was waving right away. And so that's always a good sign when the person you're looking to rescue is returning your signals.
Admiral, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Patchell is a Rear Admiral and the Commander of Maritime Forces Pacific. He's in Victoria. Music. As it happens, listeners know better than most that tongues are nothing to sniff at, or with. And we, like you, celebrate their remarkable characteristics, like the one belonging to the world record holder for longest female tongue, who uses it to play Jenga. Sorry, that is longest human female tongue. When it comes to longest canine tongues, of apparently any gender, I guess, there's a new champ. Aussie the Mastiff Mix is a mastiff success, with a lolling mouth organ measuring nearly 20 centimeters, or 8 inches, and that is just the part that hangs outside his mouth. Now, Ozzy's impressively outgoing pink lapping device reminded us of another dog whose tongue helped it win a prestigious title, that of World's Ugliest Dog. From our archives, here's Janita Benali telling guest host Janella Massa about her Chihuahua mix, Mr. Happy Face.
I describe Mr. Happy Face as having the ears of a bat, the tuft of hair like Robert Smith from The Cure, a tongue longer than Gene Simmons, quite possibly, a snarl just as cool as Billy Idol's, and he's got eyes that are filled with so much love. He stands a little crookedly, maybe a little bit like a gargoyle, and he's got a tail that's a little crooked. It kinks over because, unfortunately, it was broken and bound so that way it would have a curl. So it gets stuck on everything. But he is the sweetest soul that one could ever hope to encounter in their life.
And he definitely has some quirky characteristics, but appearance-wise, do you think he's ugly, or, you know, are you a mother who could never think her baby isn't cute?
Oh, I think Mr. Happy Face is a glorious creature. I do. And the funny thing is that when I entered him in the Sonoma Marin Fair's World Ugliest Dog Contest, I totally did not even think that he would win because I thought he was too beautiful.
So how does it feel for him to have that title?
I don't know if he knows what this title is, except that walking down the streets of New York City, he has become so popular and lots of people want to take his photograph and just want to see him. So he's getting a lot of extra attention, and I think that's pretty fabulous for him. I mean, considering that when I adopted him from the shelter just 10 months ago, he was considered to be probably the most unadoptable dog there.
Oh, wow.
And his life before was one that was from a hoarder's situation. And so when I adopted him, he was afraid of human touch. He didn't like human touch. And it took 3 months until I was allowed to touch Mr. Happy Face's face. So he's slow to warm up. But considering that he was considered the most unadoptable dog who didn't feel love, I think now, I mean, I think he must feel that the world loves him. It's not just his mommy anymore.
From 2022, that was Janita Benali talking to guest host Janella Massa about her dog, Mr. Happy Face.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Nielke Oksal. Goodbye.